Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for that very kind introduction and also for inviting me to take part in this conference. I think conferences such as this are a very valuable opportunity for people in the markets to get together and sort of exchange ideas and try and work out what's going on in times such as the present. My talk today is about economic and financial developments. I notice from the conference program, that there's quite a number of macroeconomic briefings coming up, so I was going to keep my my comments at an overview level and not go into too much detail. So, as you know, 2011 has been a frustrating year for the world economy. The recovery in most of the advanced economies lost momentum in the first half of the year, and financial market volatility and concerns about sovereign debt posed renewed threats in the second half. And this led the IMF, I think it was in September, to note that the world economy had entered a dangerous new phase. In many ways, I think all these developments, I think Stephen mentioned this, this is sort of a part of the continuing after effects of the financial crisis that started in 2008 in the North Atlantic economies. Australia, as with most of Asia, has to date been relatively shielded from the events in these North Atlantic countries. Nonetheless, the local economy has not been as buoyant as had been expected at the start of the year, and downside risks stemming from further weakness in the major overseas economies or from financial market volatility cannot be ruled out. The situation in Europe is particularly disturbing since the authorities there need to agree on policies that deal simultaneously with excessive government debt, weak banking systems, soft economic activity, and sharp differences in competitiveness amongst the various European countries. I think we've all become experts on European economic and political events over the last 6 months or so, so I don't think any of that's going to be new to you. The situation, however, I don't think is all gloom. Economic data in the United States over the past month or two have, more often than not, surprised on the upside. Asia is also continuing to do well overall. And even some of the local economic news here in Australia has been more positive of late. So let me run through some of these issues in more detail, and I'll start with the world economy. As you know, 2010 had been a very strong year for the world economy. Growth was a little over 5%, which is about as fast as the world economy ever grows. The strong growth was not surprising because most countries were applying unprecedented amounts of monetary and fiscal stimulus as they tried to overcome the or recover from the 2008-09 recession. It was always expected that economic growth in 2011 would not be as strong. So earlier in the year, the forecasters were generally expecting growth for the year of about 4.5%. And while this was lower than in 2010, that's still a very good figure. By the second quarter of the year, however, economic outcomes were beginning to disappoint. In the United States, consumer confidence and spending weakened, possibly due to the increase or the strong increases in oil prices that had taken place. US industrial production became affected by disruptions to global supply chains stemming from the Japanese earthquake. Employment growth in the US slowed, and jobless claims, which had been gradually declining, started to rise again. Growth in Europe also faltered in the second quarter, with confidence being eroded by the escalating concerns about sovereign debt in several European countries. And, of course, Japanese economic activity was severely disrupted by the earthquake. Elsewhere in the world, however, the economic activity remained robust. In fact, through most of Asia and Latin America, the concern was that the strength of economic activity was putting upward pressure on inflation, and the authorities in many of these countries were tightening monetary policy. Overall, however, forecasts for global growth in 2011 were scaled back around the middle of the year to around 4.25%, and this was mainly due to the softer outlook for the developed economies. Subsequent to this, the marked increase in financial market volatility that had occurred in the third quarter caused analysts to expect further weakening in the global economy due to the sharp falls in business and consumer confidence, as well as to the significant losses of wealth caused by the fall in share prices. The reductions in growth forecasts were again most pronounced for the developed economies. The IMF reduced growth for the United States and Euro areas down to around 1.5% for the year. Although growth forecasts for Asia and Latin America were also revised down somewhat, the forecast outcomes for these countries remained quite robust. Oh, thanks very much, Steve. While the forecast for overall growth for the world in 2011 was reduced to about 4%, that figure is still a pretty healthy outcome. It's broadly in line with trend. And in some ways, it sort of sits oddly with the very negative commentary that we tend to see. But I think that commentary reflects the fact that the outcomes for growth between the advanced economies and the emerging economies are very unbalanced. And also, there's a sense that the forecast is fragile, possibly due to severe downside risks. Now, while the forecasts have been revised down since the recent financial volatility, the run of actual economic data that has become available over that period, at least for countries outside Europe, has generally been better than might have been expected. And this, has been particularly the case in the United States. It seems to me that before the onset of financial volatility, the United States economy was starting to recover from the first half slowdown. And so far, at least, the fall in confidence that's occurred hasn't really led to a further step down in real economic activity there. Recently, analysts have been revising up their estimates for annualised US GDP growth for the third quarter, and the consensus view is now for a figure of around 2.5% to 3%. That's a moderate outcome. It's not enough to get to start getting unemployment to fall quickly, but it's a pretty good outcome. Japan is also continuing to recover gradually from the economic effects of the earthquake. And elsewhere in Asia, recent data have been mixed, although broadly consistent with the gradual slowdown that the authorities in many of these countries have been trying to achieve in order to contain inflationary pressures. India is perhaps the country that has been pursuing this approach most vigorously, and it's a country where I think growth has slowed the most noticeably. But overall, growth in the region remains quite solid. Growth in Chinese GDP over the year to September quarter was 9.1%. That's a pretty good outcome. And recent monthly data for retail sales and industrial production have been quite robust. There's also no indication of a significant slowdown in China from data on shipments of Australian coal and iron ore. The latest data that is available to the Reserve Bank, they're up to the month of September, and they show that shipments have generally held up. But since then, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen, as you know, a noticeable fall in iron ore prices, and that could, of course, be a pointer of some softening in shipments in the months ahead, in the period ahead. So let me now turn to the Australian economy. Here in Australia, 2011 got off to a shaky start despite the bright prospects offered by the second phase of the resources boom. A lot of this was due to weather events as cyclones and floods disrupted economic activity, particularly, as you know, coal production. GDP fell noticeably in the first quarter. GDP recovered in the second quarter, but overall, measured economic output in the first half of the year was pretty flat. As well as the weather-related disruptions, I think there generally remains a cautious mood amongst households and businesses. As the bank has pointed out before, in recent years there's been a structural change in household spending and financing in Australia. After a 10 to 15 year period when households increase their gearing and reduce their savings, they have returned to a more conservative and traditional pattern of financial behaviour. Household credit growth has slowed to a rate in keeping with or slightly below the growth of household incomes. The saving rate has increased to a level that is more normal based on history. And household spending growth has slowed to a rate that's from a rate that exceeded household income growth to one that over the past year has been brought in line with income growth. And within total consumer spending, there appears to have been a shift away from spending on goods in stores to spending on services, particularly services such as overseas travel, eating out and entertainment. These sectors are all doing very well. And as a result, the retail sector, the stores, are doing quite poorly. This adjustment in consumer behaviour has created a difficult trading environment for quite a few businesses, coming as it has after a prolonged boom. I think Steve mentioned some of the changes that have been taking place in sort of the distribution of wealth and financial behaviour around the world, and this is all part of it. And the adjustment in Australia, you know, even though it has caused some issues, has been quite benign compared with adjustments in household finances and housing markets elsewhere in the world. And I think importantly, it's put household spending and financing on a more sustainable path, and this ultimately will be to the benefit of the economy. In the case of business investment, there's a clear dichotomy at the present between the resource sector and the non-resource sector. Investment in the former is very high, and as you know, much more investment lies ahead. The outlook for mining investment is very, very strong. Outside the resource sector, however, business investment is relatively flat. In some cases, this is due to the damping influence of the high exchange rate, with the manufacturing and tourism industries particularly affected. In the case of tourism, the problem is not so much that foreign tourists have stopped coming to Australia, but that many more Australians are going overseas. Overseas trips by Australians are running about 60% higher than they were 5 years ago. Now, given this increase in overseas travel, it's not surprising that traditional holiday destinations in Australia, such as the Gold Coast and North Queensland, are currently among the weaker parts of the Australian economy. In other sectors, such as commercial property, the weakness in investment is mainly the result of investors and lenders having to deal with the consequences of overgearing in the pre-2008 period. When too much borrowing and lending takes place, as it did in this sector, it can take many years for the excesses to be unwound. I think some substantial adjustments have already taken place in the commercial property sector, so I think it's on the way to recovery, but the process probably still has further to run. While the sectoral composition of business investment is very uneven, the overall growth of investment has been solid, with a rise of 6% in the first half of the year. And if we look across all private demand, consumption, housing investment and business investment, it's actually rising quite subtly at the moment, it's taking the place of public spending, which at present is scaling back after the earlier fiscal stimulus. Total final demand in the economy, taking into account both private and public spending, grew by 3.4% over the year to June, and that figure's about in line with trend. However, that trend growth in demand hasn't translated to trend growth in GDP because the high exchange rate and the high import content of a lot of the business investment that's taking place has seen an increased proportion of that demand spill over into imports rather than domestic production. And, of course, the weather-related disruptions to coal exports added to the shortfall in production. In this environment, employment growth slowed, noticeably in the first half of the year, and around the middle of the year, there was some rise in unemployment. At the same time, inflationary pressures, which had declined through 2010, appeared to pick up noticeably in the first half of 2011, and the prospects were that inflation could exceed the 2-3% target range over the next couple of years. And that created, as the bank has said over the past year, quite a difficult environment for monetary policy. However, as the bank noted after the last board meeting in October, the downward revisions to the recent estimates for inflation and the softer global outlook have made the outlook for inflation less concerning than it was, and it provides scope for monetary policy to be supportive of economic activity if needed. And, of course, tomorrow's CPI data will provide further information in this regard. It still remains to be seen how the Australian economy will respond to the recent financial volatility and the consequent fall in confidence and loss of wealth. To date, however, as in the United States, the flow of monthly data in Australia has been a little better than might have been expected, given the volatile financial environment. Retail sales have picked up a little. Housing loan approvals also seem to be picking up somewhat. Most measures of business confidence remain around average levels. And the most recent employment data have been more positive after a number of weak months. Nonetheless, you know, job vacancies are lower than they were at their peak late last year, early this year. Credit growth overall remains subdued still, and the housing market is still quite soft. Recently, though, there's been some easing in financial conditions following the fall in market interest rates that accompanied the financial volatility. And banks have passed on to borrowers notable declines in interest rates on term housing loans and some business loans as their cost of funds has declined. Increased competition amongst banks is also in response to the increase in the availability of deposits and the relatively subdued demand for loans has also resulted in some shaving of interest rates on the main housing loans, the standard variable mortgage loans. This is for new borrowers. As a result, the interest rate for new loans is now about 10 to 15 basis points lower than it was at the start of the year. And I think the modest fall in the exchange rate that we've had in recent months has also, to some extent, reduced pressures on some sectors of the economy. As I've noted, there have not been signs outside Europe that the rate of growth of economic activity has taken another step down since the recent bout of financial volatility. It is, however, still too early to conclude that this is not going to happen. As we've seen from events in Europe this week, much still needs to be done there to deal with the challenges that these countries are facing. And so, therefore, I think we're going to have to expect further financial market volatility. The United States still has challenges to deal with as well in the areas of fiscal policy and housing. So it would be optimistic to assume that the United States economy will resume a robust growth anytime soon. So economic activity in large parts of the developed world is likely to remain subdued in the period ahead. And the question is whether this will flow through in due course to the large emerging market economies of the world, which have been the driving force for global growth over the last decade or so. Some flow on from the weakness in the West to the East is, of course, to be expected, even if the situation in the advanced economies doesn't deteriorate further. However, so far at least, there's not been the debilitating freezing up of trade finance that so damaged the Asian economies in 2008. More generally, domestic demand in these countries has considerable momentum, and even if it does slow more than the authorities wish or desire it to slow, they have considerable scope to provide support to demand through monetary and fiscal policy, unlike the situation in the advanced economies. And the fact that inflationary pressures in some of these economies seem to be peaking, I think, may add room for these countries to do so if they need to. Overall, while it's possible that the global economic situation might take a sharp turn for the worse, at this stage, the Reserve Bank's central scenario is that global GDP growth will be broadly in line with the long-run average over the period ahead. That would create a reasonably benign environment for the Australian economy, although the global situation remains fragile, as you know, and it needs to be monitored very carefully. So thank you very much.
You spoke about growth in China going forward and your expectations for growth. What about the area that's quite relevant to Australia, in particular the fixed asset investment capital in China, and through the GFC and post-GFC, did that bring forward some of that investment as a result? Can we see a period where their demand might be less than what we would expect otherwise?
Well, I think the Chinese demand has slowed, and they wanted to slow because the greater growth that they reached after they applied all that stimulus after the financial crisis, That was causing them problems. That was too fast, and inflation picked up very quickly again. So they're looking to slow. And I think it's in everybody's interest, including for Australia, for growth in China to slow to a more sustainable rate. You know, a rate of 8 to 10% is better for us than a rate of 10 to 12%. So, look, I've got no doubt there's some slowing underway. Mostly that was the result of intentional measures by the authorities in that country to slow the economy down to contain inflationary pressures. If the downturn gains momentum, as I said, the authorities in these countries have got plenty of scope to reverse policies and provide support, but at this stage, I don't think there's any need for them to do that.
A lot of foreign observers, if you're in the press, seem to be very worried that Australian house prices are extremely high. They've noted that Australian house prices have fallen pretty well every month this year, and some of them apparently worry that Australian house prices might fall 10, 20, 30, 40%, depending what their story is. Are you hopeful that any Reserve Bank rate cut next week might start to breathe some life back into Australian house prices?
I won't get into the rate cut story, but on the housing, I don't know how many times this question of housing prices has come up over the recent years, and it mainly comes up with foreign investors. I think part of the problem is that people see house prices haven't fallen in very many Western countries, and they can't understand why they're not falling in Australia. Part of the answer there is, there's several answers to that. One of the answers is that income growth here is much stronger than in most other advanced economies. And to the extent there has to be an adjustment in the ratio of house prices to income, it's happening with incomes rising, not so much with house prices falling. But the key difference is that the banks in Australia maintain much better lending standards than banks in many other countries overseas. The main problem in the United States was very poor lending standards. And that didn't happen here. We see pockets of it even now. And during boom times, for example, when you look at what happened in Western Australia and Perth in the run-up to 2008, when there was a boom going there, when you look at southeast Queensland in 2007, that period, lending standards did slip a bit. And we're seeing the consequences of that now. Those two areas are really going through quite a difficult adjustment in the housing market at the moment. So there's nothing is more damaging to the housing market than a lowering of lending standards. And I think the Australian banks have done very well to maintain quite high lending standards. The part of the problem is that people mismeasure the ratio of house prices to income. The most common measure that people do is they measure the ratio of prices in Australian cities to average income across the whole country. And, of course, that ratio looks quite high because incomes in the cities or incomes in the countries are much lower than incomes in the cities. If you do the calculation properly and measure house prices in the city to incomes in the city, it's fine. House prices in the country or to country incomes are all fine. So I don't think there's a problem there to deal with. At the moment, the housing market is sort of drifting slightly lower. Auction clearance rates are broadly consistent with, stable to slightly falling house prices. I think we've all got used to a situation where, house prices, we regard house price rise as being the norm. That is not necessarily the norm. And, over the long run, house prices broadly have to move with income.
Governor Josh Richardson, Josh Williamson, Citigroup. You mentioned international investors. Sometimes when we speak to international investors around the world, they're always wanting to know what the downside risks are to Australia from Europe. What is there any concern? What are the transmission mechanisms or potential transmission mechanisms from Europe to Australia? And what sort of probability does the RBA put on those actually affecting growth here?
Well, it's hard to put figures on probabilities. Our direct exposure to Europe, I think most people understand, is very limited. Particularly the Australian banks have very limited exposures to Europe. The exposure is going to come indirectly via the impact of Europe on our trading partners, particularly Asia. And nobody knows how important that's going to be. My sense is people underestimate the extent to which Asian growth is being driven by Asian demand. Most people feel that the growth we've had over the last decade or so was really US households that drove that, and it was, you know, basically Chinese exports feeding US households. If you look at the data, that's not the case. Most of the demand coming out of the advanced economies in the past decade, the decade of 2010, had slowed enormously compared with the 90s. That story was a 1990 stories. The stories of the first decade of this century was all about Asian growth and growth in Asian demand. And that's really what's been driving the world economy over the last decade, and I think that's going to continue. These countries have got a long way to go yet, and they're going to have their economic cycles like the rest of us. But on balance, these countries are busy pulling themselves out from low-income status to middle-income status, and that's going to continue. It would be extraordinary if it didn't.
I guess, Rick, just one question I could ask you, just on, you mentioned about, and comes back, I guess, to Rory's question on interest rates. You mentioned that, you know, you've got the CPI tomorrow, had a good PPI yesterday. You mentioned, though, and I think the board minutes mentioned that, you know, the course of interest rates will also depend not only on inflation, but whether the Reserve Bank needs to support the economy. What sort of things are you thinking of there that might be important in terms of supporting, you know, why the Reserve Bank might need to support the economy?
Well, this is something we're going to have to sort of form a view on over the next couple of weeks in the lead up to the board meeting. But there's the question that has to be decided is, you know, is the economy growing at a pace that is consistent with stable inflation? And, in reaching that view, there's obviously a whole range of economic indicators that we look at. As I said, so far, as the economic data in recent weeks, they've been, basically haven't taken any further step down. In fact, some of the data has been a little bit better. I think people underestimate how long it takes, even though we didn't have a recession in Australia after 2008-09 like everybody else, we did have some slowdown, and it does take time for any economy to recover from that slowdown, and we're still in the process of doing that. Even the mining boom, I mean, everybody's excited about the mining boom, but if you look at the mining booms in terms of investment, most of that still lies ahead of us. Very little of that has already taken place. It's all ahead of us still. The part of the mining boom we've benefited from to date has been the increase in export prices. That's sort of the first phase. And the impact of that on the economy has to some extent been muted by the rise in exchange rate that accompanied it. So that's redistributed that wealth around the economy, and some sectors have obviously suffered out of that. But the long-run story about the resource boom is still, I think, intact, and most of that investment is still ahead of us. So there's a whole range of indicators that we have to look at, and we'll be doing that over the next week or two.